copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
David Hume probably never told this joke, but I'm going to tell one of the dumbest jokes you ever heard, but it illustrates a central tenet of his philosophy. Two men are riding on a train from London to Edinburgh. One of them is reading a book, and after he finishes each page, he rips it from the volume and casts it out the window. Now, after observing this action for a few minutes, the other man inquires, "Sir, why are you throwing pages out of the book, out of the train, every few minutes?" "Why," the first man replies, "obviously to keep the elephants off the tracks. If we should collide with an elephant, a great loss of life could result." "But, sir," responded the second man, "there are no elephants on the tracks." Effective, isn't it? All right, now, if that's not clear to you what that joke is, turn to your neighbor and explain it to him or her to make sure everybody understands the joke. Go ahead, take a minute and do that. Make sure everybody understands the joke. If you don't get it, is there anybody that's not clear about the joke? Okay. Well, what makes this joke funny, and I use that word loosely, is that the first man thinks that throwing the torn pages out of the window is what keeps the elephants off the tracks. But the real reason is that elephants do not run loose through Great Britain. Hume would never make such a mistake about cause and effect, because he denied that there is any sure way to reason from causes to effects. He also denied that we have any direct knowledge of the external world and that we could trust the future will be like the past. So there goes the elephant. Okay? Now, this denial of cause and effect and of objective reality or the external world, or the third thing he denied, is the continuity of nature, that the past is any predictor of what's going to happen in the future. And so what happened is that David Hume showed us that there is no reason to trust reason. Because if you can't believe in cause and effect, if you can't believe in the reality of the external world, and if you can't believe that the future is going to be like the past, how can you use reason to come to the truth? Hume's skepticism about reason reveals a fatal weakness in the atheist's armor, and it puts a sharp sword in the hand of the Christian apologist. Atheists have no reason why they should value reason. And Christians can show how anyone who believes in reason should also believe in God. Now, the problem for atheists is that they deny the supernatural world. For them, in the words of Carl Sagan, as you remember, he begins the Cosmos series. Remember, I think he's walking down on Land's End in England, and you see the water coming up. And what do anybody remember the first words of the Cosmos series? "The cosmos is all there is, or ever was, or ever will be." So for him, the cosmos, with energy, matter, time, and space, is all there is. Now, in this naturalistic world, what are ideas? Ideas are epiphenomena. Epiphenomena means phenomena is what's going on, and epi means what's above it. So when you see a picture on a TV screen like you're seeing here, in one level, yes, you're seeing a picture. But what are you really seeing? The epiphenomena is the picture. But the phenomena, the real thing, are the little pixels that you'll see. Now, your brain sees the epiphenomenon, but your brain knows that it's really seeing the phenomenon. And so, ideas aren't anything real. They look real, they seem real, but they're like the apparent pictures caused by the real pixels on a TV screen. When we think, the atoms in our brain move, causing the thoughts. The atoms are the cause and the thoughts are merely the effect. Thus, Bertrand Russell could say that all human beliefs are but the accidental collocation of atoms. Collocation means coming together at the same time, in the same place. The atoms in our brain happen to move about in a certain way, and thus we think various thoughts. Now, we all know the atheists are partly right. Some thoughts do have chemical causes. LSD, for instance, and other drugs can produce sensations, perceptions, and thoughts in our brains that have no relation to the outside world. I'll give you an example from my own college experience. Downstairs from me lived one of the most brilliant students I ever knew. His name was Tom Howell. But Tom Howell was bored with Harvard, and so what he did was he started taking LSD or acid to make his intellectual life more exciting. Well, one day he got maybe some bad acid, and he thought that the braided rug, the braided circular rug on the floor of his room was a whirlpool. And he thought he was going to get sucked into that whirlpool. He cried out to his roommate, a guy named Dave Monzingo, and he said, "Save me, I'm going to get sucked down." Now, Dave knew it was just a braided rug. But Dave thought, you know, if Tom thinks he's going to get sucked down, he may go completely crazy and we may never get him back. And so Dave held Tom on his lap for 3 hours while the LSD worked his way out of the system, because Tom was so scared that the whirlpool was going to pull him down and Dave didn't want him to go completely crazy, so he held him on his lap. Now, that was a false, irrational thought, and it was caused by LSD. And so, from our limited experience, and from naturalistic worldview, atheists leap to the conclusion that all thoughts are physically caused. So here's the thought. We know this. Some thoughts are caused by chemicals. LSD causes crazy thoughts in our minds. And it's easy to move to the idea that all thoughts are caused by chemicals. If some thoughts are caused by chemicals, all thoughts must be caused by chemicals. Well, we know that people who are having an LSD trip are not in touch with reality. Thus, sometimes you have to hold them on a couch or keep them from thinking they can fly or shoot themselves. And so we know that we cannot trust thoughts that are caused by chemicals. And so it's easy then to say we cannot trust any thought. And that's the atheist problem. The atheist problem is that if some thoughts are caused by chemicals, why should they trust any thoughts at all? The problem for atheists is that having strapped on the skis of physically caused thought, they cannot stop anywhere on the mountain of rationality, but must descend into the valley of non-rationalism. See, because they have no criteria of rationality to evaluate their thoughts. A few years ago, there was a movie called A Beautiful Mind, and it was about a mathematician named John Nash. And what happened is John Nash was overcome by various phobias and obsessions. But the therapy that they had was called reality therapy. And so he fought his way back to health by testing each of his thoughts by outside criteria, by the outside standard of reason. And he decided which thoughts to trust and which thoughts to dismiss. How could he do that? Well, he used the standard of reason to decide which of the things that he thought were true and which weren't true. It's similar to when we are trying to figure out, when we think about a memory, was that a dream or was that real? We use rationality to figure out. They're both real in our memory. Sometimes you wake up in the morning and you have a very vivid memory. But is that what really happened? Or is that just a dream? And the way you evaluate that is by the standard of reason. Atheists, however, have nothing outside. There is no standard of reason. Even the real world, which they admit really is outside their brains, how does it come to their brains? How does it come to their minds? Only through their perceptions. These perceptions, they have to believe, are caused by physical changes in their brains. So by what standard do you measure the physical changes in your brain to decide this is in accord with reality, this is not in accord with reality? Since atheists believe that the cosmos is all there is, and since reason is not made up of energy, matter, time, and space, atheists have no valid reason to believe in reason. How ironic, when so many atheists call themselves brights, that they have no ability to shine the light of reason on their thoughts. Okay, now I'd like to stop here. Usually what people do is they give a whole long talk and then they ask for questions. But I'd like to stop along the way and say, are there any questions or anything I can clarify? Any objections? I want to interact with you. I don't want to just present and then have everybody ask questions. Is there anything that's not clear or anything that you'd like to talk about at this point in the lecture? Yes, please. Oh, the question, let me see if I understood the question. You say you know many atheists who are rationalists.
They are superstitious.
They are superstitious?
Yes.
G.K. Chesterton said that when you stop believing in God, it's not that you believe in nothing, it's you believe in anything. And so I think atheists sometimes, they're schizophrenic and they believe in lots of silly things because they don't have a standard. But that's a much better question to ask an atheist friend than it is to ask me, because I have, you know, I can think about that world, but it's hard to imagine how you could do that. Any other questions or comments? Okay, he asked, when we talk about atheists, are we assuming they are naturalistic atheists? Yes. And so not every atheist is a naturalist, but most are. So that's, yes, thank you so much. It's a very good clarifying question. Okay, so I'm making the point that if you're an atheist, you have to believe that energy, matter, time, and or naturalistic atheist, that you have to believe that energy, matter, time, and space is all there is. And thus, all thoughts are chemically caused. And the reason we think is because the atoms move in our brain and they create the thoughts. Well, atoms moving in your brain is not a rational process. And so atheists cannot believe that thought is rational. And rationality is not a characteristic of the physical world. And so they don't have any place else to go to evaluate their naturalistic thoughts. So that's my point, is if you're a consistent atheist, you have no reason to believe in reason. Okay, now, the second thing I want to show you is that this idea has an ancient pedigree. That this is not a brand new idea, but that atheists have known this for a long time. The idea that without God there is no reason to trust reason has an ancient pedigree. Now, the first thinkers to realize the importance of reason, to realize the impotence of reason without God to empower it, were the Greek skeptics, who doubted the ability of logic to lead them to truth. Socrates, quoted by Plato, had asked, "Are we to say that the sum of things, or what we call this universe, is controlled by a power that is irrational and blind, and by mere chance, or on the contrary, to follow our predecessors in saying that it, that is the world, is governed by reason and a wondrous regulating intelligence?" See, When you have Plato and Socrates and Aristotle, they are devoted to reason. But after them came the skeptics. And the skeptics said, no, there's not reason. Now, Socrates gave his life to follow reason. 100 years after him, the sophists arose and claimed that they could teach anyone to use logic convincingly to argue any point. They said that logic is just a tool and it can be used in any way, a tool to discover truth or a tool to hide truth. They believed that for every conceivable argument, an equal and opposing argument could be offered. For them, reason was not a divine master, as it was for Socrates, but a human tool. Illustrating this point, an orator named Carneades in Rome gave equally persuasive speeches for and against justice on successive days in 155 BC. And they thought this was a great proof that logic was and reason were not something outside of human beings, but just a tool. This is Carneades. Now, about over 1,000 years later, a second attack on atheistic reason came from the Muslim. His name is Al-Ghazali. In his book called The Destruction of the Philosophers, argued from optical illusions that we cannot trust our senses. Now, let me show you how that works. Take your thumb and put it up and make it so it makes me disappear. You can put your thumb and you can completely make my whole torso disappear. So your senses would tell you that your thumb is bigger than my whole torso. Now, you know that's not true, but your senses tell you that. So Al-Ghazali said you can't always trust your senses. And we know about perspective, so we use reason to correct our senses. But then Al-Ghazali used things like Zeno's paradoxes to argue that reason didn't really work. This Frenchman, his name is Pierre Cabini, he boldly proclaimed the brain secretes thought as the liver secretes bile. Now, this was about the same time that David Hume was expressing his skepticism. So the idea is that thought is just a biological byproduct. And that's that your liver, bile comes out of your liver, thought comes out of your brain, and neither one of them is a great guide to reality. Now, David Hume's attack on rationality roused this man. Okay, what's the terrible pun? I mean, you at least ought to groan when I say, I can't refute Hume. Okay, all right. Immanuel Kant produced two critiques, a critique of practical reason and a critique of pure reason. He said that Hume roused him from his dogmatic slumbers, but he was not able to refute Hume. He was able just to point out that reason cannot give us truth in the physical world or in the moral world. After Kant, Charles Darwin realized the same thing. He realized his brain taught him that it and a monkey's brain shared a common ancestor. But then ironically asked, would anyone trust the convictions of a monkey's mind? So if my mind and a monkey's mind have a common ancestor, they are different in degree but not in kind. But why would I ever trust what a monkey thought? Shortly after Darwin, another British scientist, British philosopher, who the Brits were smart enough to elect as prime minister, named Arthur Balfour, pointed out in this book, The Foundations of Belief, being notes introductory to the study of theology. What he pointed out was that since empirical science can only give a non-rational source for human beliefs, such science must be supplemented by the belief in God if human thinking is to have any validity. Now, noted atheist J.B.S. Haldane. J.B.S. Haldane is a really interesting guy. One time, he's a noted atheist. One time they asked him, if you weren't an atheist, what would you know about God from the natural world? And he said, well, if there is a God, he has an inordinate fondness for beetles. Because I believe there are 6 million species of beetles. And so that's what he thought. He also, during World War I, said, I've never had the experience of killing anyone, and I would like to know what that's like. And so as long as there's peacetime in Britain, I'm unlikely to ever have that experience. So he enlisted in World War I so he would know what it was like to kill somebody. Whether he actually fulfilled that or not, I'm not sure. But that's a story about Haldane. But those are just interesting stories about Haldane to keep you back and get your attention. But what he said was that, he said this, that if my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true. In order to escape what he called sawing off the branch on which he sat, he felt compelled to believe in something like a mind which exists behind nature. And yet he still called himself an atheist. I am an atheist, but outside the world of nature, there is a mind. Now, in our time, C.S. Lewis has noted what he called the fatal self-contradiction of naturalism, showing a materialist view of the universe leaves no place for rational thought. He does that in his book, Miracles. Thus, naturalism is autophagous. You ever heard that word, autophagous? Autophagous. Okay, you have to imagine this. What I do when I want to illustrate autophagous for my students, I go to the blackboard, and I stand in front of it. This is not going to work, it's okay. And I stand in front of it so they can't see what I'm writing. And then I write, please do not read this. And I step away. And then, of course, they all read it, and it tells them not to read it. And so writing, please do not read this, but you can't understand what to do unless you read it, is autophagous. That means it eats itself. Auto is self, phagos is stomach. So something that's self-contradictory is autophagous. Well, that naturalism is autophagous, devouring itself, much like a bumper sticker put up by the Unitarians in the United States, which imperiously orders us to question authority. I love that. A bumper sticker says, question authority. And I say, why should I do that? Okay. Cosmologist Paul Davies. Oh, I'm sorry. Here's Alvin Plantinga. Alvin Plantinga has written a book called Where the Conflict Really Lies. And he points out, it's a book about religion and science. And he says, if materialism is true, then there's no reason to believe it, making the same argument that Lewis and others have made. So Plantinga is an American philosopher who's done this. And then here's Paul Davies. Paul Davies is an Australian cosmologist. He makes the same point of the inability of naturalism to account for rational thought. He shows that evolution explains why our minds allow us to avoid dangers and to find mates, but then arguing that natural selection cannot account for our rational human minds with their ability to understand everything from atoms to black holes. Davies has been backed up by this atheist philosopher, Thomas Nagel, who calls the evolutionary explanation of human reason laughably inadequate. Now, not only is naturalism unable to account for rationality, it's also unable to guarantee that the human mind grasps truth, whether by rational or irrational means. Here's his book called Mind and Cosmos. And he says that the Darwinian view is not able to explain why there's a mind or why we see order in the natural world. Here are two Darwinians. And the first one, Donald Hoffman and Chetan Prakash, they wrote that when survivability and truth collide, survivability wins. Remember, in Darwinism, The only thing that counts is survivability. So if you have a false belief that enables you to reproduce more than somebody else, your false belief is going to triumph over his true belief. And they've actually argued that the survivability will always triumph over truth. Natural selection often drives true perceptions to extinction when they compete with perceptions tuned to fitness rather than truth. Here are two more. You can see their names, Ajit Varkey and Danny Bauer. They think this loss of truth is not necessarily a tragedy. In fact, one such displacement of truth by survivability, they say, resulted in the emergence of humanity. And here's what they say. They assert that subhuman creatures know they will die. And I mean, this seems unbelievable to me, but they've argued this. They say subhuman creatures know they will die and thus do not invest their time and energy in products and projects that will take more than a single human lifetime to complete. But when one branch of primates, your ancestors and mine, randomly mutated a massive capacity for denial, they forgot their own deaths and they launched into projects such as scientific discoveries and technological innovation, and thus became human in the process. The thing that differentiates us from Cro-Magnons or from Neanderthals is that we deny that we're going to die. And so we try to do things that are going to last longer than a human lifetime. They think all human thinking arose from the lie of immortality. You can't make this stuff up. Okay. Recently, Stephen Hawking, the man who held Isaac Newton's chair at Trinity College, Cambridge, published a book called The Grand Design, in which he thinks, and here's that book, in which he thinks that everything can be explained without the hypothesis of God. On the opening page, he says, philosophy is dead, meaning that speculation about the universe is pointless and only science will lead to truth. Now, Hawking seems to have forgotten that trying to do science without philosophy is like trying to do language without grammar. Philosophy is not so much a separate branch of investigation, but the rational way to conduct all investigation. He uses the alleged death of philosophy as a cover for the absurd statement, such as, because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Yeah, that's what he says. Hawking apparently does not notice that gravity is not an independent entity, which can do things on its own, but it's only a human personification of the tendency of masses to attract each other. Nor does he realize that when he posits gravity as the creator, he gives no account for its origin. Nor does he recognize that without mass, there is no gravity. If there were no mass, how would you ever know that there was gravity? Gravity is a property of mass. It's not something that existed before mass. Hawking's unconscious irrationality, like the conscious rebellions of earlier thinkers against rationality, is just the latest instance of how abandoning God leads the atheist to abandon reason and even truth. So, not only does thinking about reason reveal a fatal weakness in the atheist's armor, it also puts a sharp sword in the hand of the Christian apologist. Okay, so let's stop here. What I first showed about irrational thought. Now I'm showing how through history people have realized that atheists had no reason to trust reason. Do you have any questions or comments about that part of the lecture? Any clarifications? Yes, sir, in the back. Okay, a traditional atheist in a debate with you admitted, I have no basis for my rationality. And the second man tried to avoid the problem by saying, it doesn't matter. I'm a nihilist and I don't need reason. It's just a matter of, everything's a matter of opinion. Is that accurate?
Exactly, that's what he said.
And so you're backing up. You're saying that what you're talking about, Chuck, is true and I've seen it in real life.
Absolutely.
It's not just in books, it's in debates. And so the question is, if a nihilist comes and says it's all just a matter of opinion, then Well, here's what I would say. Shut up, he explained. Because, I mean, if there's no basis for talk, it all becomes power.
Yeah.
If there's no rationality, then how are you going to decide things? Let's arm wrestle, you know, or let's yell, or let's see who's got the most money, or, yeah, it becomes then a power game. And postmoderns or hypermoderns will acknowledge that. They say all speaking, all communication is a power game. And they recognize that. And then you say, well, you know, I'm going to turn off your power. You know, it's so dehumanizing.
Yeah.
Because then the one with the biggest stick or the biggest army wins.
And Schaefer predicted all this, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Well, Oliver Wendell Holmes in the United States back in the 1870s, he said it around the 1870s. In around 1915, he became Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. And he said, law is the majority opinion of the nation that can lick all the others. Law is the majority opinion of the nation that can lick all the others. So if Germany had won World War II, it would have been right to kill the Jews. If the South had won the Civil War, slavery would be morally right. That kind of an argument. And once again, that's just power. And there's nothing. I mean, it's what John Lennon said when he said, imagine there's just the flat ground and there's nothing above to judge. Then we're all animals. It's a horrendous thing to think about.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thank you for providing that example. Okay, so now I want to show you why, if you believe in reason, you're going to get pointed to God. Okay, not only does thinking about reason reveal a fatal weakness in the atheist's armor, it puts a sharp sword in the heart of the hand of the Christian apologist. In order to maintain one's trust in reason, one must come to trust in God. Belief in reason frees the mind from its naturalistic prison and allows entrance into a world containing spiritual realities. Once reason gets its spiritual foot in the door, the entry of God cannot be far behind. Now, the argument is not from reason to God is not one of deduction. And you know what deduction is. Nor is it one of induction. But it's one of abduction. Abduction, inference to the best explanation. Now, given that any situation can be explained in an infinity of ways, which explanation best accounts for the situation? Abductive reasoning is the key to the situational riddles that kids love. Let me tell you one of them. Don't shout out the answer if your teenagers have told you this. Okay, here's the situation. You come into a room and Billy and Sally are dead on the floor. They are surrounded by puddles of water and broken glass. They have no wounds on their bodies. And they have not been poisoned. So what happened? Now you're allowed to tell. Anybody know what happened? Whoops. Let me go back here. Okay. Did you see the picture? They're goldfish. So what happened? They're goldfish. And somebody knocked over the bowl fell over. Okay. Now, that's abductive reasoning. Now, given the human ability to reason correctly, what is the best explanation of this phenomenon? Either reason comes from a naturalistic, non-rational cause, or it comes from an immaterial, rational cause. More than 20 centuries of thought have shown that non-rational physical forces cannot give rise to rationality. Matter can never give rise to mind, much less to rationality. Thus, human reason must rise from a rational source. Beside the physical universe, then, there must be a non-human rational mind. And this mind must be the source of human rationality. This human rationality enables people rightly to reason, to evaluate their thoughts, to see which are logical and coherent. It is not a product of one's mind, but comes from outside and enables one to control the mind. Now, in addition to adjudicating between human thoughts. This rationality also empowers people to understand the created order, the cosmos, so beloved by Carl Sagan. So how ironic that his favorite word for the universe was cosmos, which comes from the Greek word meaning beauty and bespeaks its order and intelligibility. Not only inside the human mind does reason rule, but outside our heads, it seems to impose its laws upon the created order. Because reason reigns both in the physical universe and in our consciousness, humans can comprehend both worlds. They can order their thoughts and understand the cosmos. When thinkers realize that a trust in reason leads them to a non-human, immaterial mind, which also stamped its mark on the universe, they soon discover they believe in God. Now, the idea that reason exists independent of humans and that shapes the world began with the Greeks. 6 centuries before Christ, Heraclitus said there was a logos, a word or reason by which the world was created. The men against whom the sophists rebelled, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, all believed in the logos and the spiritual reality which it and God inhabited. Around the time of Jesus, Philo the Jew, said this logos was God's creative principle. And John's gospel here says, "Enarche hein ho logos." In the beginning was logic, or in the beginning was the Word. And John's gospel identifies the logos with God the Son who created everything. So Greeks, Jews, and Christians have long linked our human ability to reason with God's existence as well as his creativity and our ability to understand the world. Now here's Descartes. Descartes created modern philosophy by questioning everything he did not know directly. He eventually reasoned that God must exist. Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, began a process that finally convinced him there was a God. Now, his train of reasoning was long and complex, but recently, the Oxford mathematician John Lennox, who has been here and spoken, in response to Hawking's book, has telescoped the complicated arguments into a simple deduction. Cogito ergo Deus est. I think, therefore, God exists. And that's a little bit like what Anselm did. Anselm, in his ontological argument, says, I'm taking a lot of arguments and simplifying them down into one. And that's what John Lennox did. Einstein marveled that the most incomprehensible fact about the universe was the fact that it was comprehensible. Why in the world, if our minds were just made for reproduction, can we understand the world so well? John Lennox explains why it is so. Both the universe and the human mind come from the logos, and the logos is God, QED, cogito ergo Deus est. I believe, therefore God exists. So Christians have a sharp two-edged sword. They can ask atheists why they trust in reason, and they can show them that without God, such a reliance is blind faith. Then they can show them that the best inference for the existence of reason and the intelligibility of the universe is the God of the Bible. Enarche hein ho logos. In the beginning, there was logic. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.